or lease from...
The royalty of college football is in assembly.
Oh, my gracious, Tim. How about that?
We just stepped on their face with a hot-nailed vision across their nose.
Clenzo strikes with a minute and a half left.
Welcome to the College Football Country Podcast. My name is Josh Parcell, the host and founder of College Football Country. Thank you guys so much for listening. We're back for year two, our sophomore season of the podcast. This is the second episode. If you missed last week's episode, I broke down my top 10 quarterbacks, the first edition of QB Rank, where I took a look at what in my mind are the 10 best quarterbacks in college football going into this season. Number one was Will Grier. Check out the rest of the list, though. Go back and listen to that episode if you missed it. I'll get into today the coaches under the most pressure to win in 2018. I'll rank my five coaches who are under the most pressure. I'll talk about a few others as well. I did, however, want to start with the Maryland story. I know it's not a good story. Pretty much any news right around now isn't good news in college football this time of year, but we're closing in on the season and we'll be able to put some of these stories hopefully behind us. As for the story out of Maryland, last Friday ESPN reported there is a culture of toxic behavior within the Maryland football program. DJ Durkin has been in College Park for 2 years. He has built a program that was based around fear and intimidation at the University of Maryland. And some of the stories were just absolutely pure evil. One of those being obviously the death of Jordan McNair. And it was a tragic story. Players in college football have died in the past. It's happened. What has not happened is what took place at Maryland, where there was a failure to report the symptoms that Jordan McNair suffered after the workout in late May. It was almost an entire hour after McNair started suffering the symptoms that would normally tip somebody off to call 911, to get an ambulance, to get McNair treatment. It didn't happen. Almost an hour before 911 was called, McNair died 2 weeks later. It was a horrible story. It was a tragic story. And it was one that opened up a look inside the Maryland program. ESPN reporting that Rick Court, the strength and conditioning coach at Maryland, was the one who really spearheaded a lot of this, what they called intimidation, a culture of intimidation and fear at Maryland. There were stories of players being overfed food until they vomited to the point of throwing up because they didn't weigh enough. There were stories of players having weights thrown at them in the weight room during workouts. Those are things that just flat out do not happen at every football program, nor should they happen at any football program. And the thing that really irritated me about this whole story is the response afterwards, when the report came out on Friday and you started to read about just the types of things that the players would have to go through, that the coaches would put these players through on a daily basis. And you start to realize that it's not football. Yet some people seem to think that it was. Some people seem to believe that those types of actions, that kind of behavior, is somehow the way it should be because that's how we did it back in my day. That's how we grew up. That's just the sport. That's tough love. It is not tough love. It is not the way things should be. It is not building discipline. It's not teaching players a damn thing. What it's doing is showing how not to run a program. There can be ways to teach 18 to 22-year-olds discipline that don't involve verbal and physical abuse. This was a culture of evil. This was something that should never, ever happen again. And Will Muschamp said on Saturday, he defended DJ Durkin, who he worked with at Florida. And I respect the fact that Will Muschamp has a relationship with DJ Durkin. I get it. I understand you want to protect your friends, people you've worked closely with. I get the urge to do it. But at the same time, when Will Muschamp criticized the reporting of ESPN, the fact that anonymous sources were used, which is something that is very acceptable in the world of journalism when people are trying to protect their name, or especially around cases as sensitive as this. I understand wanting to use anonymous sources and people being tentative, I guess, to put their name onto a quote with a story as sensitive as this one. For Will Muschamp to dispute the validity of those reports because simply because the quotes and the sources were anonymous is ignorant and naive on Will Muschamp's part, and it's flat out embarrassing. And I don't normally get this worked up over things. I try to keep this podcast fun. I don't love to get into the negative stories, not because I think they're not worth talking about. It's just that I don't want to have to spend time talking about things as sad and upsetting as this story at Maryland. But the amount of ignorance and naivety from coaches, administrators around several college football programs is so worrisome. Because football is a sport that, for a long time, is maybe as rooted and as stuck in the past and old traditions as any sport that we know. A lot of people, Larry Fedora included, he was the one who really started this, or at least brought this back to light about a month ago. A lot of people tend to think of football almost as something similar to the military. And they treat it like it's the army, and in fact, football is not the military. We should not be treating these young men who play a game like they are about to go to war in the Middle East. There's ways to teach football players discipline, and there's ways to build their character without demeaning them and humiliating them. I'm not saying you can't yell and cuss and scream at players and berate them for mistakes. That happens. I've been a coach. I've coached basketball. I've coached football. I'm not saying I've gone off and verbally abused players because I've come nowhere close. I've seen coaches who have, let's just put it mildly, filthy mouths when it comes to criticizing players between the white lines, between the practice field. But different strokes for different folks, I understand that. But there is a line. And it comes far before you start to physically abuse players, forcing them to vomit on their own meals, throwing weights at players, and obviously, most tragically, not reporting symptoms that could lead to death. And that's what happened with Jordan McNair. On Tuesday, Maryland held a press conference that Wallace Lowe, the president of the university, spoke first and apologized to the family, said he had met with the family that earlier Tuesday morning, and basically tried to cover up everything that Maryland has done over the last 2 months or not done. They tried to make up for those mistakes in a press conference on Tuesday. I'm sorry, but that press conference would not have taken place. The conversations with that family, the McNair family, the parents of this child who was killed, would not have taken place. These conversations would not have happened if it weren't for ESPN's report. So say what you want about anonymous sources. Say what you want about journalism and the validity of whatever happened in those reports. But the reality is, if it weren't for Heather Dinich and Adam Rittenberg and the people who reported on that story and unmasked the culture around the Maryland program, there would be no apology. There would have been no conversation. There would have been no internal investigation into everything, the actions and the environment and the culture of Maryland football. I hope that this doesn't take place other places, but let's be honest, you know that it does. There's plenty of other programs around the country where stories like this, unfortunately, might happen. Just last year, Oregon lost a player in Willie Taggart's first few months to a workout. Not to say the two stories are identical, because they're not. Players dying as part of workouts, unfortunately, has happened over the years. But when it becomes systemic and it becomes so ingrained in the behavior of the staff, like it did at Maryland, that's when it becomes worrisome. And you just hope that something like this doesn't happen somewhere else that leads to another unnecessary and senseless death. So that's enough for the sad stuff. It's a terrible story. We'll find out what happens to DJ Durkin going forward. It sounds like he's going to keep his job for the time being. They did dismiss Rick Court, the strength and conditioning coach, on Monday, settled for $350,000, and now that story may be, at least from a national point of view, in the rearview mirror. Now we move on to the 2018 season, and I ranked my top five coaches under the most pressure to win in 2018. Now, it's not necessarily a hot seat ranking. You get a lot of hot seat rankings leading into the season. You hear it every year. The hot seat really never goes away. We're going to now, it's almost a 12-month a year topic. Week in and week out, after every win and loss, it seems like coaches' livelihoods are hanging in the balance. I get it. I understand it. And this ranking is not necessarily meant to be just a strictly a hot seat ranking, but just coaches who are just under the most pressure. They need to win and win big based on what the fan base expects, the expectations that they've set for themselves as the coach, depending on how long they've been with the program, contracts, things of that nature. It's, again, not just necessarily a hot seat ranking, although any coach on this list of the top five could feasibly lose their job if things go sideways in 2018. It could happen. So some of the guys who did not make the list really quickly, Jimbo Fisher did not make the list, but he was very close. This is a guy who signed a $75 million contract to take over the Texas A&M job. There is no grace period in College Station. The Aggies expect Jimbo Fisher to turn this thing around very quickly. This first year might be the only year where he's going to have a pass if A&M starts to struggle. They do have a tough game against Clemson at home early in the season. Of course, they play Alabama and Auburn in the SEC West, the toughest of the divisions in the SEC. It's going to be a bumpy road for Jimbo Fisher in year one, and I could see nowhere near hot seat talk coming out of College Station. Of course, that's not going to happen. But A&M could go 5-7 this year. They could go 6-6. There's some talent on the roster. They've got some issues at quarterback. But Jimbo Fisher, he said it himself at SEC Media Days, the expectation is to come in and win immediately. Expected to contend for national championships. Jimbo Fisher's not shying away from those expectations. That was clearly the bar that was set when A&M paid him what they paid him. They put an empty trophy case in his office, basically telling you, look, this is where we're going. This is the direction we want the program to go. We are not satisfied being a middle-of-the-road SEC team. We want to win national titles and be a contender. They may have missed the boat on taking advantage of Texas's struggles because Tom Herman is starting to turn things around just a few hundred miles away in Austin. But Jimbo Fisher, make no mistake, is under a lot of pressure to win in year one. Speaking of Tom Herman, he is also under a lot of pressure in just his second year at Texas. He comes in last year, showed some signs of life. It was actually funny. He comes in with the reputation as an offensive guy, but it was the defense that actually was the better unit of the two. Last year, finished third in the Big 12 in scoring defense, finished second in total defense. And the offense kind of sputtered a little bit. Finished towards the back half of the Big 12. You had some quarterback issues with Sam Ellinger, Shane Buechele. That isn't going away, and how Tom Herman navigates that will really, I think, determine Texas's fate here in this season. They're a preseason top 25 team. They've always had the talent to contend in the Big 12. This year is no different. Herman has recruited extremely well. Charlie Strong recruited well at times, but Texas has a very tough schedule. They play Maryland in week one. That game, they'll have revenge on their mind. It takes place at FedEx Field. So basically a road game. And then USC at home in week three. They get USC, TCU right after that. So several games early on in the season that are losable. They're winnable, but they're also losable. Swing games early in the season for Texas. Tom Herman has to get off to a hot start or else some people may start to just put a close eye on the progress that he's making at Texas. And that's not an indictment of Herman. That's just the nature of the business when you're the head coach of the Longhorns. There is no patience in Austin. They expect to contend. They're tired and sick of losing as much as they have. And 7-6 last season, quite honestly, even though it was year one for Herman, was a bit of a disappointment. I think people in Texas thought Herman would have more of an impact, especially on the offensive side, than he did early on. He's got to figure out the quarterback situation and go from there. So he doesn't make my top five, but I do think Herman is one of the coaches under the most pressure to win this season. The other two guys, quickly, Herm Edwards in his first year at Arizona State. Not a whole lot has gone right since the day that Edwards was hired. He lost both of his coordinators. Billy Napier left very quickly at the offensive side and losing the defensive coordinator as well. For the Sun Devils, was not a good look. They're trying this new philosophy at Arizona State where Edwards is a CEO and the assistants really handle maybe more of the workload than at some other schools, and Herm is seen more as a CEO. They're trying to emulate what the NFL model is. But reality is the NFL model is different than the college model. And in college, I think you have to be a little bit more in tune with these kids from a recruiting standpoint. Herm has got to be able to go into homes and connect with young players. Now, he has, and I've seen it up close and personal, he has spent several years working at the Under Armour All-American Camp. So he's been around young athletes, high school athletes, star high school athletes. He's been around it. It's not like John Gruden, where Gruden's has been in the booth for 10 years and hasn't really done any real coaching other than some gimmicky 30-minute show on ESPN. Herm Edwards has at least been around it a little bit. But he does seem a little out of touch. Some of the comments he's made, even I think it was a couple weeks after he took the job, he said recruiting was harder than he thought it was going to be. Not exactly what you want to hear if you're Arizona State. So it's year one. He's not going to be fired after his first season. But I think a lot of people are going to be very closely watching the progress Arizona State makes because they do have some talent. Manny Wilkins is an experienced quarterback. N'Keal Harry, one of the best receivers in college football. He is going to be a future NFL stud, I believe. So there's talent on that roster. The Pac-12 South is up for grabs. Arizona State doesn't figure to be at the top of the division. But again, Herm Edwards needs the season to start probably more than any other coach in college football, just so he can start to play games and stop losing the PR battle that he's seemed to be fighting ever since he took the job back in late January, early February. Now, moving on, Bronco Mendenhall is the last one who didn't make the cut. Look, he's not going to lose his job either at the end of this season. They showed progress at Virginia last year, making a bowl game for the first time in several seasons. Not a lot of talent to speak of on that Virginia team. They returned six starters on the defensive side, five on the offensive side. The quarterback, Bryce Perkins, is a transfer from Boise State. He's going to be a dual-threat quarterback, something Virginia hasn't had in a long time. So they're going to have a lot of questions. They should be the worst team in the Coastal Division. It's not a great division, though. So if Bronco can steal a couple wins from the likes of Duke, North Carolina is going to be pretty down this year. There's at least a chance for Bronco to point to something positive. The gap, though, between Virginia Tech and Virginia is as big as I can remember it ever in my lifetime. And that's really, really sad for the Virginia Cavaliers because there's no reason Virginia should be as bad as it is. They're in a great area for talent. They're just an hour or two down the road from the Hampton Roads, Tidewater area. They can pull kids from there anytime that they want. They're just a couple hours away from D.C., Northern Virginia, where there's a ton of talent. They are firmly placed in such a much even better, geographically speaking, they're in a better place than Virginia Tech to try and recruit talented players from the state. And the reality is Virginia Tech is so far, miles ahead of the University of Virginia right now, that Bronco Mendenhall, I don't know if he's ever going to be able to dig himself out of this hole. Some of the comments he made this season, this offseason, about only having 27 ACC caliber players, and these were comments made, they were supposed to be behind closed doors, they weren't, are not a good look. And it gives you an idea, and it gives you a peek inside just the state of Virginia right now, because if Bronco Mendenhall is willing to admit that behind closed doors, you know that it is an uphill road. So for Virginia, if they were somehow able to squeak out six wins this season, it would be a miracle. I think this team is more along the lines of a 3-4, maybe a 5-win team. That's not going to cost Bronco Mendenhall his job, but at some point you've got to show signs of life. And if they take that step backwards this year, it's going to mean that 2019 is probably a make or break year for Mendenhall at Virginia. He's a good coach. The fit never made a lot of sense to me, and the microscope will loom even larger if Virginia struggles in 2018. So that leads me to my top five list. We got those honorable mentions out of the way, and now it's time for the countdown. The number five coach under the most pressure to win, and this is a coach who is on the hot seat, is Cliff Kingsbury at Texas Tech. Look, Kingsbury was hired 6 years ago in what was college football's most blatant PR stunt maybe that I've ever seen. This is a guy who was in his early 30s, had run the offense at Texas A&M, led Johnny Manziel, helped lead Johnny Manziel to the Heisman Trophy. He was a legend at Texas Tech. He played for Mike Leach. We know the story. He was hired way before he was ready to be a head coach. We've seen cases in the past of young offensive masterminds getting head coaching jobs earlier than they probably deserved and it not panning out. Mark Helfrich was one. Lane Kiffin was another. Look, being a head coach is so much different. It's a lot different than being an offensive coordinator. You can understand the X's and O's. You can go up and be a wizard on the whiteboard. But when it comes to managing a program, you're the CEO, you're the executive. You have to organize the program. You have to do so many things beyond sitting in the meeting room, breaking down tape, and designing a game plan. It's just so much harder. And Kingsbury has failed this at every step of the way. He's 30-33 in six seasons in Lubbock. He's averaged 5.5 wins per season over the last 4 years. He's never finished higher than fifth place in the Big 12. There's only 10 teams in the Big 12, and they've never finished in the upper half. He's never finished better than 50th on the defensive side in yards per play allowed. I use yards per play because it's so much better of a stat than just true yards, especially in the Big 12. But he's never finished better than 50th nationally in yards per play on defense. They have never had a pulse on the defensive side. They actually hope that this season might be the best defense they've had yet. They return 9 starters. They could maybe even be an average defense, which would be a win, as sad as that is, for Texas Tech. Bill Connolly from SB Nation, who does such a great job previewing these teams, he has 6 wins, right around 6 wins for Texas Tech this year. I lean towards the under. I think the schedule sets up for them to max out at 6 at the absolute most, which means I think more realistically this is a 5-7 type team. And that would probably signal the end of the run for Kingsbury at Texas Tech. He's beloved by the fan base. He's got a great personality. He's a great face of your program. But they're not winning games. Now, I know Mike Leach, he only won 10 games one time at Texas Tech. It was kind of a common misconception about Leach when he was there, is that they were this constant contender in the Big 12. They had the one great year in 2007. And, or I guess it was 2008. 2008 was the great year with Michael Crabtree and that group. Yet every other year, Texas Tech failed to reach double digits in the win column. So it's not like the bar is that high for Texas Tech, but you need to be a little bit better than where Kingsbury has had this program for the better part of 6 seasons, averaging less than 6 wins, not enough. He would be a tremendous offensive coordinator. I mean, I can only imagine the amount of the number of bidders, the number of suitors he would have if Texas Tech let him go at the end of this year. You think about schools like LSU, who has lacked an offensive pulse for almost 20 years now, would love to have someone like Kingsbury coming in to run the offense. He would make perfect sense, just not as a head coach. So the expectation at Texas Tech, I think, this year should be 8 wins. And I think if Texas Tech wins 6 or fewer, even if they make a bowl, but 6 wins or fewer, I could see Kingsbury being on the out at Texas Tech. Number four coach under the most pressure to win. I don't think he should be on the hot seat. Some people disagree with me. Is Jim Harbaugh at Michigan? Harbaugh and hot seat do not belong in the same sentence, period. But it is reality that the media and even the fan base to some extent at Michigan has created a sense that Harbaugh's first 3 years in Ann Arbor have been a failure. They haven't been a failure whatsoever. He won 10 games in back-to-back years, took a small step backwards last year as they replaced a lot of veterans. And this Michigan program has been relevant the entire time Harbaugh has been on the sideline. When he took the job, and he did some funny things. He took his shirt off. He ran around at a camp. He slept over at a recruit's house. He did a lot of stuff that we had never really seen before in college football. And it drew a lot of attention to himself, and it drew a lot of attention to the program. And when they weren't able to win the Big Ten East, even in any of the last few seasons, it started to create this blowback from, really, in my mind, the national media, that all of a sudden Harbaugh was somehow talking, or I guess whatever it is, that he talking a talk that he couldn't walk the walk. That just isn't quite accurate, because the margin for error in college football can be extremely slim sometimes. And for Michigan, never more so than in the rivalry games that they've lost over the last few years. In his first season, they lost to Michigan State on arguably the biggest fluke play in the last 15 years, where they muff the punt, Michigan State picks it up, runs it back for a score. on the final play of the game in the Big House, cost them the game against Michigan State. The next season in 2016, a controversial spot on a fourth down cost them the game against Ohio State in a rivalry game on the road in the Horseshoe. Ohio State eventually makes the playoff in 2016. So they were inches away from knocking off a playoff team, and would have actually, Michigan would have ended up playing for the Big Ten title had that happened. So they were very, very close. Even last year against Michigan State, a game that was played in an absolute hurricane-like conditions up in East Lansing, it's just tough to judge Jim Harbaugh based on a 1-5 record against his rivals, which is what everybody has pointed to so far. If you want to look at what Jim Harbaugh has done, he has recruited at an elite level ever since he set foot in Michigan. He has won double-digit games in 2 years. He's made a New Year's Six Bowl. He has produced NFL talent. He has struggled to find a quarterback so far, and for that, he deserves criticism. But to be ready after 3 years to push Jim Harbaugh out the door, who else do you expect to bring into Michigan that's going to do a better job than Jim Harbaugh? He is a Michigan man. He understands the culture. He loves Ann Arbor. And he has won far more games and turned around far worse programs than the job that he had when he began at Michigan. Now, Brady Hoke left Michigan in a pretty rough spot, recruited okay at times, recruited some good players, but the depth at Michigan was severely lacking. Harbaugh took it immediately and made them a very good program again. This year, can they take that big step forward? That's going to be the big question. Shea Patterson is the new quarterback. Harbaugh refuses to name him the starter. They're still battling it out with Brandon Peters, but it's going to be Patterson. He's the game changer. He's the dynamic guy, the Johnny Manziel type, the scrambler who gives a dimension to Jim Harbaugh's offense that they really haven't had at Michigan, and he hasn't had in the college game really ever. He did have it with Colin Kaepernick in San Francisco where he had a mobile guy. So we'll see what Harbaugh can do with Patterson this season. The schedule is tough. They play Notre Dame on the road week one. It's a very difficult game to open up the season. And then they have Wisconsin, Michigan State, and Penn State in a three-game stretch. They play those three in a four-week span in the middle of the season. Wisconsin's going to be a top 10 team. Michigan State's a top 25 team. And Penn State is a borderline top 10 team. So to play those three in a span of 4 weeks with just a bye in between the Michigan State and Penn State game, that does not bode well for Michigan. So what's going to be really frustrating, because I can see it already, is this Michigan team is probably going to lose two of these 4 to 5 tough games. They also have Ohio State, of course, at the end of the season. So between Notre Dame, Wisconsin, Michigan State, Penn State, and Ohio State, I can see Michigan going 2-3 in that stretch, and people are going to want to burn Harbaugh at the stake for struggling in those big games. Michigan is still young. They have a terrific defense. They're breaking in the new quarterback in Patterson, who has a few years of eligibility remaining. The offense is extremely young. This team is really built, I think, for a championship contender in 2019. I just hope that the fans and the media allow Harbaugh to get to that point. This team is closing the gap so much every year, and I think this year they're going to have maybe their best team since Harbaugh has been at Michigan. But the division also may be tougher than it's ever been since he's been there. I expect them to win 9 games. I think the expectation for Harbaugh should go 9-3, and he will be fired if they win 5 games or fewer, and maybe not even then. The hot seat talk, I think, is a farce. If Michigan goes 5-7, I think next year he enters the season on a very hot seat. But I don't think you can fire Harbaugh, even if they've somehow missed a bowl, after just 3 years, given the state of the program when he took over, the struggles they had for a decade after Lloyd Carr left, and what his resume entails pre-Michigan. He has proven himself to be a fabulous, tremendous football coach, and one bad year shouldn't be enough to derail that. I don't think 5 wins is possible. I think this is going to be a 7-8 win team at worst, and again, realistically, probably around 9. That's where I go for number 4 is Jim Harbaugh. The top 3, number 3 coach under the most pressure to win in 2018 is Larry Fedora. And Larry Fedora at North Carolina, I touched on this a little bit in last week's podcast. Another name that I don't necessarily agree should be on the hot seat, should be under a ton of pressure to win, but he is. And some of it has to do with things that really aren't even on the field. And it began with the comments he made at ACC Media Day in July, where he talked about the war on football and some other really kind of maniacal comments that really weren't backed up with any support, at least none that he could articulate at Media Day. That, I think, set off some alarms, probably with some boosters and certainly with the administration, that they need to keep a watchful eye on Fedora going forward. But again, the reality is Larry Fedora is a tremendous football coach. He took over at North Carolina at a time when it was one of the toughest coaching jobs really of the past decade in college football. They had the NCAA investigation hanging over their heads. It's, of course, a basketball school. If at UNC you win a championship in basketball, they're building statues of you. They're naming the court after you. Whereas if you win a national championship in football, they hang a sign outside your office and tell you nice job. That's really all you get at North Carolina. It's not a football school. It never will be a football school. And very, very few programs like North Carolina have ever been able to master the art of playing at a high level in both sports. The money, the attention, it goes to basketball in Chapel Hill. And if you can just be a competent, competitive football program, I think that's all they really want from you. And just 3 years ago, North Carolina went to the ACC championship game, pushed Clemson to the wire, and Clemson eventually made it to the national championship game that year. That was as great as of a season as you can ask for, I think, at North Carolina. Every now and then, you can pop up and win 9, 10, maybe even 11 games in a great year. If you can just stay above water, 7 to 8 wins as your floor, everything should be fine at North Carolina. 7 wins could be asking a lot this year, but it's doable. North Carolina lost so many players to injury last season, 34 scholarship players, where it was enough attrition where I don't think that 3-9 record that North Carolina had last season is anything you can hold against Larry Fedora. It's just, how many coaches could survive losing virtually half your roster to injuries at some point throughout last season? It was a tough, tough spot for Larry Fedora. He didn't forget how to coach in a year. Before last season, every single winter when jobs would come open, major jobs, high-profile jobs would come open, Larry Fedora's name was on the list of coaches in the mix for a lot of those jobs. That was for a reason, okay? He is a very strong offensive mind. He has won games not only at North Carolina but also at Southern Miss. He has proven to be a winning football coach, win healthy. This year will be an important year for him, and I put him on this list as a coach who's under a lot of pressure to win, not just because it's easy to say he's on the hot seat, but I just think that there's going to be so many eyes on him. I would not fire him after this year, really, regardless of what happens, because I throw away what happened in that 3-9 season. UNC's over-under is 5.5 wins. It's going to be tough for them to get back to a bowl game. If they go 4-8 this year, again, I think it means that 2019 becomes the year where Larry Fedora is coaching for his job. I just don't think that this should be the year. Yes, the suspensions that came down last week are not a great look for the program, but that's not a Larry Fedora problem. That is a 18 to 22-year-old problem. Players would sell shoes regardless of who the head coach was, regardless of what school they played for. That's just something that idiot kids are going to do. Larry Fedora reacted appropriately to everything that took place this offseason as far as the investigation into the selling of the shoes and whatever. I think that the school knows the microscope that it's under by the NCAA. It's handled everything by the book. And Larry Fedora deserves praise and credit for the way he handled that. The expectation for North Carolina, if you're a booster, if you're somebody who's keeping an eye on whether or not Fedora should keep his job, I think 7 wins would be plenty to keep Fedora safe. It's not a great season, but it's enough for, I think, North Carolina to take a deep breath and say, let's give this guy a chance to see this program through. If they win 5 or less, I could see Fedora being gone. Personally, I would not fire him after one bad season. Again, because I don't take any stock in what happened last year, thanks to the injuries. But I could see a 5-7 Larry Fedora being handed his walking papers. Just the way it is. I understand the pressure to win in college football is great sometimes, even at North Carolina, a basketball school. So Fedora is under a lot of pressure to win. I would happily take Fedora as my head coach if I was looking for one this coming winter if North Carolina lets him go. Two more to go. Number two on this list of coaches under the most pressure to win is Ed Orgeron at Oregon. This one seems like a fairly obvious one. He was really an uninspiring hire from the get-go at LSU. He's going into his second season. And when you think back to Les Miles being fired in the middle of the 2015 season, or I guess 2016 season, Les Miles was fired because he could not close the gap with Alabama. That's the bar that LSU measures himself against, and it's the Crimson Tide, and it's Nick Saban. The gap between Alabama and LSU is wider today than I think it ever was under Les Miles. Probably not a great sign when you're going into your second year with Ed Orgeron. He already had his struggles at Ole Miss. There were questions about his ability to run a program. And then what happens only a month in to last season, his first year as the head coach? They stripped the play calling duties from Matt Canada, who by all accounts is one of the best offensive coordinators in the country now at Maryland, already showed signs of instability, of shakiness, of concern for the way the program has been run by Coach O. Ed Orgeron's a great recruiter, but there are a lot of people who could recruit to LSU. And if LSU struggles this season, if the Tigers go 7-5, 8-4, which is entirely possible, they don't have a quarterback they feel strongly about. They took Jeff Burrow off of Ohio State's hands, so they get the Buckeyes sloppy seconds at quarterback. They lost Darius Geis at running back, although they should be okay in the backfield. There's no reason to think this offense is going to be any better than it's been in the last 10 years or more, and the defense is replacing a lot of key guys as well. So if they backslide again, I could absolutely see LSU having to pay another enormous buyout and moving on from Coach O after 2 years. You just don't have the room to be patient if you're LSU, because there are so many other programs in the SEC spending the money to try and beat you. If LSU is not careful, Texas A&M with Jimbo Fisher, who has ties to Louisiana and can recruit the state, as well as, of course, the ties to Florida, and now he's going to start to take an even bigger foothold in Texas. Texas A&M is going to be nipping at the heels of LSU. If the Tigers aren't careful, the Aggies would pass them in the pecking order in the division. Alabama and Auburn seem to be a solid 1-2 right now. So for LSU, the patience should be very, very thin with Coach Orgeron. Now, the other coaches that could make sense at LSU, and I don't want to go into a ton of detail because we'll have plenty of time to talk about this throughout the season, but just some names that, as I was thinking about who makes sense as maybe a better fit than Orgeron, Chris Peterson jumps to my mind immediately. Not an SEC guy, but an offensive mastermind, someone who could maybe hit a wall at Washington this year, depending on how their season unfolds. I don't know that he would come and take the job. He's always been a Northwest guy. But LSU has the cachet and the tradition to be able to try and recruit a guy nationally, can go out and try to find the biggest name possible. Peterson would probably be that guy. Other guys, Jeff Brohm at Purdue. If Purdue continues to build on what Brohm did in year one, which was outstanding work last season, Brohm is an offensive wizard. He has more ties to the Southeast, obviously, than Peterson, being a guy from the Louisville, Western Kentucky background. He would be a tremendous fit at LSU. Justin Fuente at Virginia Tech, another guy with roots in Texas, Oklahoma. So he has that Midwest, South, the Southern ties. I don't think he'd be at the top of their list, most likely because I don't think Virginia Tech's going to have a tremendous year this season. I think that if Virginia Tech wins 8 games, that would be a success. LSU's not hiring a guy who just comes off an 8-win season in the ACC. So I think Fuente would have to have a banner year in Blacksburg to be in the mix for LSU if it comes open. Other guys would be Neil Brown, the head coach at Troy, who beat LSU last year in Death Valley. Neil Brown has done an outstanding job at Troy. He wouldn't be number one. He wouldn't be choice A. He probably wouldn't even be choice B, but they could do a heck of a lot worse than Neil Brown, who not a lot of people know of because he's at Troy, but he's done a great job. The last guy would be Dave Aranda. Dave Aranda is the defensive coordinator now. He's 41. He has orchestrated some of the most dominant defenses of the last 5 years, both at Wisconsin and at LSU. If Aranda were to get the job, again, he wouldn't be the top choice, but he would be someone who would keep the continuity on the defensive side and could go out and hire an offensive mastermind, maybe even like a Cliff Kingsbury, who I mentioned before, that might be out of work at the end of the year at Texas Tech. So a lot of names in the mix for that LSU job. And another name that I'll throw out there, I don't think it would happen, but if I'm LSU, I at least call and ask, James Franklin. James Franklin would be a home run at LSU. He's doing extremely well at Penn State. I can't imagine him wanting to leave at this point. They're really about to hit, I think, an even higher level at Penn State with Franklin now firmly entrenched as the guy. But he did coach at Vanderbilt. He's been in the SEC before. LSU has a lot of money, and they've got a much more fertile recruiting ground. James Franklin would win national championships at LSU. So from the Tigers, I at least see if he's interested. The expectation for LSU, because it's LSU, is 10 wins this season. I don't think it's likely that happens. I don't think LSU gets to 10. I think that they're more likely going to be about an 8-4 team, maybe even 7-5. And I think that's enough to fire Ed Orgeron. I think if they finish with 8 wins or less, I could see Ed Orgeron being on the chopping block because, like I said, the gap is just going to get wider and wider between the top of the SEC West and LSU, and there is no reason why LSU should not be the best team in the SEC along with Alabama. They should be neck and neck fighting every year for the crown in that conference, and they're nowhere close as it stands today. And finally, the number one coach under the most pressure to win this season, and I want to reiterate, this is not necessarily a hot seat ranking because I don't think there's a big narrative around Dana Holgorsen whether or not he's coaching for his job, but I do think Holgorsen is the number one coach under the most pressure to win. Because if you think about West Virginia, they have in 5 seasons since the 2011 season, they have only won 10 games one time. Now, West Virginia is not exactly a powerhouse, but they are a program with proud tradition, and they are a program that expects to win. Dana Holgorsen has not been able to do that consistently at West Virginia. This is a team that's had a lot of expectation. They've had a lot of firepower. They've had some great offenses. They've had some great players, and they've yet to translate that into Big 12 contention. If it was ever going to happen, it was going to be this season. They've got Will Grier back for year two. He is a Heisman candidate at quarterback. He threw for 3,500 yards plus last season. He has great receivers. David Sills is going to be an outstanding guy, probably a Biletnikoff candidate. He'll be near the top of just about every major receiving category this season. They've got the players. They've got the talent. The Jimmys and Joes, they're there. The conference is wide open. Oklahoma is the favorite in the Big 12. But we don't know how good the Sooners are going to be. Without Baker Mayfield there, if you listen to my podcast last week, you heard how high I am on Kyler Murray. But even I understand that we don't know what we're going to get from Kyler Murray in the Oklahoma offense until we see it. West Virginia has a chance. The door is open for the Mountaineers to step up and win. Not just contend, but win the Big 12. We've heard this now a few times where West Virginia's had this talent. How many chances is Dana Holgorsen going to get to build a Big 12 contender? This may be his best chance, and it might be his last chance. They should be favored in all but one game until November. Okay, they go on the road to NC State in week 3, and outside of that, this team should cruise to a 7-1 record, maybe even 8-0, before they go in and face TCU, Texas, Oklahoma State, and Oklahoma all in the final month of the season. That's going to be the defining stretch for West Virginia, but they've got to get to that point first. If you remember back to the Geno Smith era at West Virginia, they got off to the hot start in, I believe, 2014. Might have been 2013, actually. And then everything fell apart after that. And this cannot happen this season. Holgorsen has got to sustain a high level of play week in and week out. He's got the players on offense to do it. The defense is a huge question mark. But you could say that about so many teams in the Big 12. I don't even know that it matters. I think West Virginia is capable of making a run at the Big 12, but they're going to have to get to 7-1 or maybe even 8-0 going into that final month where they have something to play for. If they stumble in a game or two earlier, maybe an Iowa State trips them up in October and this team is out of Big 12 contention before they even get to that stretch, you could see the season getting away from them real fast. The expectation for West Virginia should be 10 wins. And I think if they dip even to 7-5, 7 wins or fewer, I could see West Virginia deciding that enough's enough with Dana Holgorsen. Let's try and find another guy who can maybe get us over the hump at West Virginia. And it would just be a case of the program, I think, growing a little stale. Dana Holgorsen has not ever really had a horrible season in Morgantown. They just haven't had a great season since making the Orange Bowl in his first year when they knocked off Clemson in that blowout win in Miami. They need to step it up this year. And one key stat to keep in mind before we wrap this up with West Virginia that nobody would really notice or most people are not going to bring up when talking about the Mountaineers, they only have 73 scholarship players. 85 is the limit. Over the course of the season, that can absolutely add up. Most people don't think about the depth and the impact that that has, especially at the Power 5 level. But you've got to be able to have guys who can fill in when there's injuries, nicks and bumps and bruises and things like that that happens over the course of the season. In the Big 12, where the pace is as rapid as it is in every game, you've got to be able to go too deep, especially on defense. West Virginia playing with only 73 guys on scholarship, that is a disadvantage. That's the fewest number of scholarship players on a roster in the Big 12. Those are the little things. Those are the little details that could ultimately cost a team like West Virginia. So I think Dana Holgorsen is under a lot of pressure. When you talk about hot seat coaches, he's not the first name that comes to mind. But if you think about it, there has never been a better chance for West Virginia to win the Big 12 than there is this season. But it could easily go the other way as well, mostly because of the schedule, but some questions on the defensive side, and just because this is what we've come to know from the Mountaineers under Holgorsen, 7-5 is equally as possible as 11 or 12-1. So there you have it. The coach is under the most pressure to win in 2018. The quick recap: at 5 was Kingsbury from Texas Tech. At number 4 was Jim Harbaugh. Number 3 was Larry Fedora. Number 2, Ed Orgeron. And number 1, Dana Holgorsen. If you had to ask me out of those 5, how many will lose their job at the end of this year, I would say it's likely to see at least 2 of them gone. I think Kingsbury is almost certainly going to be fired unless he turns things around in a big way. I think Larry Fedora, unfortunately, could be on the way out. And I could see Ed Orgeron as well. So I think 2 out of those 5 will, I would say 2 will lose their job. The 2 most likely being Kingsbury and Fedora. But I could see as many as 4. I could see Orgeron and Holgorsen both being on the way out as well. I think the only one on this list whose job is safe, unless absolutely the bottom falls out, is Jim Harbaugh. So we'll see what happens this season. Let me know what you guys think. I would love to hear your feedback. I got some tweets after last week's episode with some thoughts on who you think is under the most pressure, maybe what you think the expectation should be for some of these guys. Any coaches who I forgot, let me know. Tweet me at Josh Parcell. And be sure to listen up, because coming up here in the next week, I'm going to start rolling out my over-unders for the season. We'll go conference by conference. So first up will be the ACC, and then we'll move through the rest of the Power 5 conferences. I'll have a guest on every episode. We'll break down over-unders. We'll go through every team in the Power 5. We'll tell you which ones are good bets, bad bets, just give our picks in a fun way to preview the season. We've only got 2.5 weeks, and we're going to be playing football. I cannot wait for that to get started. In the meantime, make sure you're still listening to the podcast. Tell your friends about it. I think it's going to be a great year for the show. I'm excited for some of the guests that are coming up. Rossi Three Stacks will make his return soon. Don't you worry. Peter Burns is going to join me to talk SEC over-unders. I'll also have Kevin McGuire to do the Big Ten and several other big names as well. So it's going to be great working on some awesome episodes for you guys. Keep subscribing and listening. Thanks for listening to this episode, and I will see you guys soon. Take care.